here's a case of a pregnant woman who's 6 months pregnant being forced to sleep in a car to turn on an engine to keep warm in the middle of snow and ice in modern Ireland, in an apartment that's owned by the county council and rent is paid to the county council. So
welcome to the Social Fabric podcast with me, Andrea Splendori, and this week my guest is Rory McKiernan. Rory is an award-winning social innovator, speaker, charity founder, campaigner, and podcast host. He's also the author of best-selling book, Hitching for Hope, A Journey into the Heart and Soul of Ireland. The songs in this podcast have been shortened for rights reason. You can find the full playlist on Spotify under Social Fabric. The show is also broadcast weekly on Near FM every Monday at 3:30 p.m. and on Flirt FM every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Please subscribe, share, and review. It's the only way podcasts like this have a chance to survive. For more information and more episodes, please visit andreasplendori.com. The title tune is Alice by Lucky Bones.
Can I call you up, oh Alice, on a Friday night? We could reminisce on old days and we could talk a while. Sit and talk a while.
All right, Rory. So listen, I was going through things, and I know a bit about you. I didn't know a huge amount about you. I first came across you. You interviewed Mary Kennedy. I think it was one of the early ones. She's an acquaintance of mine. I know her from years ago. So that's how I came about. I listened to that podcast at the time, and I liked the format. I liked what you were talking about. So that's really when you came on my radar. And I always stayed in the back of my mind, I must try to talk to Rory, because although our paths are completely different, I think our destination is very similar. I think your vision of what the world can look like and mine can be very similar, I like to think, because you're very much about community connections, and that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. It's very much there. So the way we get into it is slightly different, but I think if we were to draw the picture of where we're going, it probably look very similar, I like to think. Yeah. So this, I tell you what I like to start, if I could, is from your book, because although I haven't read it, I watched the TEDx talk and I know a bit about it, and I just love the whole concept around. Tell me a bit about that whole process, and more so, where is it now that it's been out, it's been a bestseller, and reflecting back to the last year or so, tell me a bit about that.
Well, where do you start with the last year? There's so much can be said and has been said, but specifically the book starts off with me experiencing severe burnout. Several years ago, I'd founded a nonprofit organization specifically focused on young people. It's called spunout.ie. Founded about 15 years ago while living in Donegal, even though I'm originally from Cavan, and had sort of built that up with a great group of people over 7 or 8 years, and basically overcooked it. And so I got spun out by spun out, and there was no fuel left in the tank, and the fire went out a bit, and I was feeling quite lost in myself and decided to walk away into the unknown. And that coincided with the collapse of the Celtic Tiger economy, kind of boom to bust time in Ireland, and a lot of despair in the air. And so there was a kind of a inner outer mirroring going on. And so this question of hope came to the surface for me, and hope for myself, hope for Ireland, hope for the planet. And through a range of opportunities or circumstance, or sometimes the way ideas come to people, they're mysterious creatures. This notion of going around Ireland emerged, and talking to people about hope, and add to that the prospect of hitchhiking to do it. So that's what I did. It was an incredible adventure. I learned an awful lot about myself, about Ireland, about people, about humanity. And then the real adventure, or the second adventure rather, began when I was encouraged to write a book about it. And that became a whole nother story in itself. And then it had a third part whereby the book came out in March, late March 2020, during the very first lockdown of the pandemic, and bookshops were closed. And I was releasing a book about hope into the middle or the start of a pandemic, when I suppose I was faced with the challenge of how does one launch a book during a pandemic? And yeah, so that I've been on this train for a while now, and now I'm zooming around the world having online launches and events, and it's become an entirely different thing. So it's shape-shifting at every juncture, and that's, it's perfect because it's just all a big adventure.
Yeah, and I like that because, I mean, I thought I actually went out to write a book. I thought you went out to hitchhike to actually write a book, but that was, you went on a journey. You went on a personal journey.
No, my book writing experience goes back 20 years. I was once on the radio when I was 23. Actually, the Marion Finucane show, which I think she had the Joe Duffy slot. And I was going on having a rant about globalization and corporate power and democracy or something. And a publisher had heard me speak. I must have said something half sensible because they contacted me and asked me to write a book about globalization or try. And I did. I wrote a third of a book. And in the end, it got the better. I just couldn't do it. It was too hard. And I said I'd never do that again. And it's not necessarily my disposition to sit for long periods of time and have the discipline and focus that is required to write and finish a book. So yes, everybody can write a book, but can they? There are much better writers than me in the world, for sure. I don't consider myself having any great writing credentials, but it really taught me a lot about focus, discipline, endurance, stamina. And I've had to, use those virtues before, but I certainly never wanted to write a book, but the book demanded to be written. And you often hear that said about any kind of creative endeavor, that it just had to be done.
Yeah, fantastic.
Why? I don't know.
Yeah, no, but I like what you said. One thing really caught my ear when I was listening to your TEDx talk. The listening is a radical act. You know, I thought that was very well put. And I'm a great believer in listening. That's why I'm doing this podcast. I'm a believer in I have no agenda. I just want to know what you have to say. And whether I agree with it, is it relevant? It's out there. But just when how long did it take you going around Ireland to, I mean, was it just the one stretch, or did you go off and on and off on different paths?
No, it was just one stretch. So this is the thing. I've been writing about this and speaking about this now for about 7 years. And I rarely say how long it took, because part of me can't even believe how little time it took. This was only a 1 month project. And here I am all these years later, and it's still rippling along. But as I said, it's changed course and reverberated and it's created all these ripples. But so much happened within that 1 month. Every day was a massive adventure. And I ended up speaking to hundreds of people and hearing hundreds of stories. And I suppose I did share some of those on social media and national media as well. And that became a point at which people wanted or seemed to want to hear more and know more. And it felt at some point that, yes, I'd been encouraged to write a book, but that the internal driver that really led me to commit and finish was a sense that it wasn't my story anymore, that I had been given and honored with these stories and voices, and that I was entrusted. I was a trustee, and it was now my duty, in a sense, to fulfill the journey and to bring it back to people, in a sense. But that's not to separate myself entirely from it. We're all in our own things as well. So,
yeah. Wow, that's really interesting. Well, obviously, it's credit to you to actually have listened to the stories and have taken, the stories to heart, to condense them into Well, I have to say, I haven't read the book yet. I just in the last, I remember when you launched it, as in on Zoom, and I thought, okay, I must go along to that. And then I've been on a journey of studying in the last year, so I've been swamped with studies. So one of these days, I will pick it up very soon and read through it. But tell me about your first song there, Rory. What did you pick?
So yeah, it's so hard to pick songs when there's so many amazing songs out there, but I picked somebody that I think you may also be a fan of, and that's Colin McInerney, and it's Emer's Dream. And it's just a stunning piece of wizardry of music and just raw emotion, heart, transcendent quality to it, as does all of his music. But it also, we were kind of blessed with the fact that he played it at our wedding, Susan and I's wedding. So it has different kind of resonance and also brings you to different places and different moments. So yeah, great piece of music, great guy.
Oh, it's a fantastic, he's a good friend of mine, and that song has been following me for the last number of years for different reasons, and it's fantastic, it's an amazing piece. Stay with the hope, right? And the book, The Hitching for Hope. And you just say, you know, what a year has been. But having written the book and having seen what has been the last year, has been a kind of, I don't know, I don't know how to describe it. It's just, it's almost surreal. Where's the hope come from at the moment for you or for anybody you're talking to about hope?
Yeah, I suppose I personally am getting a lot of hope in, and this emerges as a key theme of the book, in first of all in finding a sense of simplicity and the ability to kind of embrace elements of slowness and solitude, which I have to admit for the last few days I have not been doing that, but generally speaking, not flying around the place, not traveling around the place, you know, there's a greater stillness quality at present. And I think that can allow our spirits to catch up with us if we allow that in, even though there might be resistance there and we might be dying to get off here, there, or everywhere, and obviously missing family and friends and so on. But to be able to kind of catch up with your spirit, to see the beauty in everyday life and reconnect with oneself and, you know, maybe your wife or whoever it might be, and listen to music, read books, whatever it is, think about new projects, new creations, new possibilities, to see that there is a kind of meta reflection going on in the world. Cause I certainly didn't think everything was going well before the pandemic. And it's not like, oh, we were, everything was fantastic and suddenly this bad thing happened. It's like sudden, I felt like all these bad things were happening. We were on a course, certainly ecologically and socially, culturally, economically, spiritually, on a dysfunctional path that was causing a lot of suffering on a physical level and certainly on a mental level, where there's a mental health epidemic of depression, suicide, whatever it might be. Anxiety is so rife as well. But I'm also get hope through action, which is in some ways the opposite of the stillness, in that, you know, it's all well and good to kind of meditate and reflect, but at some level we need to kind of get stuck in. And I'm trying to kind of always balance those two forces at any given time. It's almost, I suppose that brings us to the Tao and the Tao of living, that it's push and pull, ebb and flow, and to find the art and balance of living. And at the moment I'm on a big push, specifically around some Syrian refugees in County Longford that are in a very distressful situation due to negligence on the part of their landlord. And I'm in a fight at the moment with others and pressuring TDs, politicians, media, Longford County Council. And I'm really connected to these people that I don't know that have somehow got through the world's most devastating modern humanitarian catastrophe in the Syrian war, lived in refugee camps for years, have ended up in Ireland and are now in distress because of their situation in Ireland. And I suppose I'm kind of getting hope by seeing people come in behind that, but also from the endurance and resilience that the families in question are showing, that I don't feel I have any right to feel any despair when connected to this family, these families that are living this and have already overcome so much. Hope is this kind of, it's an ever changing quality, isn't it? It like changes shape. And certainly if I was to spend too much time reading the headlines, I wouldn't have much hope left. Or if I believed all the headlines and I believed that that was the only version of reality. But the truth is there's always kindness, there's always goodness, there's always great change happening in a positive sense as well as on the other hand. Yeah.
Yeah, totally agree with that. And in terms of like, you know, you talk to a lot of people, you do a lot of public speaking, and, you know, I was looking at your calendar search for 2021, you know, it's already busy enough with different things you're going to be doing, Irish Support Agency and Cultural Centre, et cetera, et cetera. But do you feel that you live in the west of Ireland, am I right?
Yeah, I'm here in Lahinch, County Clare. Yeah,
fabulous place. And one of the best pubs ever, closed a couple of years ago, unfortunately, Frowley. One of the best pubs.
Yeah, well, the good news is it's reopened.
Oh, is it? Oh, fantastic.
But the bad news is it's closed down because of the pandemic. But the good news is it'll reopen again.
But the reason I mentioned Frowley is not because I am dreaming of that pint in Frowley eventually. But that to me is the kind of the essence of what I love, which is, you know, walking to a place full of strangers and have a conversation over a pint and then walk away. And when you're having all this conversation, do you feel now that, aside from the pub, do you feel that the pandemic has kind of creating some hope in a way, just by what you said, virtually what you said earlier on, bringing things a little bit calmer, a little bit more, having that time to talk to one another a little bit more, because you can't go anywhere, can't go outside the 5K at the moment. So
I think it's so personal to an individual. Like, there might be somebody listening now that is just really in survival mode with trying to work from home, busy job, two kids under five. You know, there's a spectrum there. It might be, you know, somebody that's a carer, an elderly person that hasn't seen anyone in months or months. And so I think we need to be careful of like projecting our own sense of possibility or hope onto anyone's given situation. But for me, yeah, it's a mixed bag on any given day. When I see the Irish government's response, there have been moments where I thought, yeah, they're kind of not doing a bad job, you know, but really, I feel like at the moment, I don't have great hope there. But I'm getting great hope in the Irish people's reaction, in that there seems to be an asserted voice emerging around. And to be honest with you, from the beginning, I felt it was the Irish people who were driving the response. So the Irish government did not want to close down the pubs. They did not want to cancel Paddy's Day. You know, it was continually like what is sometimes dismissed as the Twitterati or the outraged voices. But, you know, if you think wider than that, that's actually just people. It's Irish people that often don't have a forum for their voice. Now, I know it can sometimes take a nasty or a toxic course, but more often than not, there's a sentiment that's seeking to be expressed there. And what you have is like Irish people setting the agenda, and that's really good democracy. But what I would like is that we could have kind of visionary leadership, like leadership that isn't reactionary constantly, and that just like we let them off for the 4-year term and can generally trust them to do a good job and not have to continually shout and demand. So back to the refugee situation, you know, I've had to work on this full time for a few days and I'm like, what on earth is going on? There's so many well-paid officials and including agencies and nonprofits that are supposed to be working on this. Why can't it just get done without the media getting involved? But yeah, I've had to yesterday go on the radio a couple of times, you know, dealing with newspaper queries. So I don't get a lot of hope from those places, but I do get a lot of hope from the people that stand up and speak out. And but sometimes it's not just those people, because it's sometimes leadership is done in a quiet way as well. It's behind the scenes. Maybe it's just looking after your family as well. You know, it's just, I kind of get hope from people's determination, perseverance, resilience, strength. And at any one given time, somebody is probably grappling with something. It could be mortgage repayments. It could be the business they started. It could be the fact that they really want to do a master's degree this year and can't. It could be the fact that, like yourself, they may have family abroad and haven't seen them or won't see them. Sorry, I don't know if that is the case.
Yeah, that is the case. It's fine.
Yeah. I have a brother living in China, you know, so we haven't seen them in over a year now. And, you know, my mother's granddaughter, my niece, you know, those years are precious. So it is a challenging time, and we shouldn't try to over spiritualize or over philosophize it into a positive when we can allow it to be shitty and painful as well. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't need to be the defining narrative, like that it can be both, and that you can experience the pain and the joy in the one moment almost. And so on any given day, like I find that it's a range of those emotions. But on the whole, where I'm at personally is in a generally hopeful place. But that's largely because of the practices that I try to enact on a daily basis and get myself out of bed, try and get dressed. Those simple things. I try and go for a swim every day. I have a couple of swim buddies that we do the social distance swim thing. I have a great wife. We watch a bit of TV. I do work really hard, which actually at the moment is actually helpful because it just means I just focus on the work. You can also lose yourself in work again. So I need to watch that. That's really an Achilles heel. But just every day. And then I'm kind of generally pretty good increasingly about taking the weekends off. So it's learning those boundaries of how we be in the world and find out where our weak points are, and you know.
And you do a lot of different things, and you know they're all within the same between writing, podcasting, and social innovation. Founding a charity, etc. But for example, I don't know anything about this Syrian refugee that you just mentioned. Is it covered much on the news, or am I just missing it out? And how did you pick that fight? How do you pick your fights? Because you can't fight.
Oh, them. How do you pick a fight? That's a great question. Carefully is the answer. So I didn't pick the fight. The fight picked me in this instance. I was contacted by someone I know living in the area that this is happening, and said, look, we've been trying to resolve this for a long time and we're not getting anywhere through the due process. So we kind of suspect that you may be able to do something. So this is just 12 days ago. And I then set about contacting TDs and relevant nonprofits and so on. And I said, here's the situation as I understand it. Specifically the headline alarm bell being, here's a case of a pregnant woman who's 6 months pregnant being forced to sleep in a car to turn on an engine to keep warm in the middle of snow and ice in modern Ireland in an apartment that's owned by the county council and rent is paid to the county council. So now this is going on for homeless people and many others. It's just one example that has been brought to my attention. And so this is unacceptable. And we think of the mother and baby homes and pregnant women and all that. And I'm like, well, the reason that well, one of the reasons that happened was because the institutional culture at the time facilitated it. But, you know, I don't know. I don't want to speculate about too much about that. But I do know that it's important to just make some decisions that that's not acceptable. And for me, that was just, I'm not going to just pretend I didn't hear that. So anyway, I tried to then, I assumed that kind of raising alarm bells and giving it a wee push would allow things to take their course. I gave it about a week and nothing happened, nothing. Now, I've lobbied politicians in the past. Some of them wouldn't know who I am. Some of them wouldn't. So I didn't want to go to Twitter. I didn't want to go to the media. Sometimes that noise thing doesn't quite work either. But eventually I was like, okay, I have no choice. And then I had to just write, it's game on here a couple of days ago and just go at it hard. I mean, hard. And you just create, you know, you create a storm. And at all, you know, it's so fundamental to keep it factual, keep my own emotional stuff out of it. But at the same time, as Peter McVerry said to me, anger is an important force if channeled. So, and then to really demand accountability and demand action and to be not afraid to name names. And sometimes that's uncomfortable because you have to put your neck out and there may be a sense of what do people think of you and why are you doing it? What's your agenda? You know, but you just need to transcend all of that and know why you're doing it and what you're doing it. And at all times do it in consultation with the people that matter. That makes sure that you're not going off on an ego trip or you're misrepresenting a situation. You're not abusing anybody, you know. So just continually push online, emails, phone calls, whatever it takes. And then in the last 12 hours, 24 hours, the media have really got on board and are now contacting me for comment. I did not want to comment. I wanted like the voice to be from the families, people on the ground. Unfortunately, there was nobody able or willing, comfortable to do that. So I had to take on that role. And then now it's, you know, national newspapers have covered it and radio and so on. And but it's still not resolved. Yeah. So, which I can't quite believe, but I'm determined that it will be, and that's all I know. I'm not going to let it drop. And there's people there on salaries of 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, possibly 90, possibly 100,000 euro a year. I'm talking council officials, I'm talking TDs, and just get it done. Like, just it's to do with substandard housing, it's to do with poor ventilation, leakages, mold, and ultimately a really dysfunctional heating system. And like, just get it fixed. Wow. You know,
it's amazing. Unbeknown to me, we were gonna talk about this. I read an article yesterday by Fionn Davenport on The Guardian, which probably is coming all about how we're failing, refugees and the direct provision the same way we failed the modern baby homes. So it's a really interesting article, very similar.
Yeah, I haven't read that. I heard about it and I've made that point in my Twitter thread that for me, I keep thinking of the institutional inertia that allows this to happen. Now, you could argue there's a social inertia perhaps around that, but there's certainly an institutional thing where there's a real sense of this is nothing to do with me. That's to do with the other department. Certainly we look into that. And not even that. Sometimes it's just being blanked. And in Ireland, we have to really redefine our state and the culture within it, particularly when it's concerned that notion realm of public service. And we need to re-emphasize the word service and servant and public servant to serve the public, who works for who. But that's also up to us as a public to remind people who's the boss here, whether it be through freedom of information request, whether it be just being an absolute pain in their asses. But unfortunately, it shouldn't really need to be like that. Now, I know other countries have this. I know we're not unique. But at the same time, we're a pretty modern state and there's really no excuse. And it's also draining a lot of time and money for everybody. Nobody's actually winning in these scenarios, including me. I'm not getting anything out of it, you know. Yeah. So it's just like, you know, it's time to grow up and just, it's not that complicated, some of this stuff.
Very good. Fair play to you. What's your second song, Rory?
Well, I need to calm down after my rant here. you can see my blood gets up about these matters, which actually may be appropriate for my next song. So the song I'm going to go with is War by Bob Marley.
And reason?
It probably doesn't need too much explanation there, but I've been a long time reggae music fan and Bob Marley fan since young teenage years. And there's something about the sensibility and the spirit of the music to a kind of sense of defiance, strength, resistance, but also hope, action, empowerment, belief, and a kind of a celebration in that as well. Like, you know, so it's just, I think it's such powerful music. And I'm reminded of Sinead O'Connor singing it as well at the time she really stood up to the Pope at a time when people wouldn't stand up to the Pope and clerical abuse and cover-ups and so on. So it's an important song in a whole number of ways.
Until the philosophy which old one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war.
Just to calm you down a little bit.
Thanks, I'll do my, I'll have a wee meditation here.
No, it's fascinating because, I mean, if I read back through the things that you've done, you know, I'm just curious about two things. One, where that activism and wanting for change come from, you know, going back to a little bit when you were a bit younger. Where did that come from? You know, is there any influence coming out? You know, was it your parents? Was it your uncle or something? Or where did it come from? And also, following on that, how is it that changed? You know, with people you've influenced in a way through your spinage and through all the other things you're doing, do you see that activism in the new generation, the next generation, happening a bit more?
Well, I would say that there's always been activism, you know, because nothing would get done if there wasn't, in a sense. Like, it's activism that created the Irish state, independence, various countries, post-colonial independence around the world. It's activism that started youth clubs and sports clubs and stood up to apartheid and the Berlin Wall. And, you know, it wasn't. So I think it's just part of who we are as people. But then for me personally, certainly there was an influence growing up around volunteerism and active citizenship, and my parents just being involved in local youth or sports groups and the credit union movement and things like that. And then I suppose there was a kind of an interest in the ether around the troubles in the north. I grew up 20 miles south of the border, so it was very alive. I was on our TV screens. We'd cross the border regularly, checkpoints, soldiers, that kind of thing. So I suppose I started to kind of get curious about why things were the way they were and why, you know, then when I went to university in Scotland, I kind of got interested more. Studied business at university, but I suppose business is another way of understanding society and power. But it wasn't until really I moved to San Francisco after university that I really kind of started to ask those bigger questions on a deeper level. And travel exposed me to a lot of people, cultures, stories. And then eventually, like anything in this world, you see a problem or you feel a solution. And at some point you have to go, somebody should do something about that. And then eventually it's like, well, maybe I should do something about that. And you try to do something, and some things work, some things don't, some things are small, some things are big, and you just continually learn. And so it's always been like that for the last 20 odd years now, just trying all sorts of stuff, you know, and you know, don't think there's any one recipe for anything to fix or change anything. So I'm very conscious that it's part of my own growth and evolution to understand myself and my role in all of this. And it's really important that we step back and not become a missionary, mercenary figure. So it's important to know why you're doing it. And like, even I referenced Peter McVeary in, I interviewed him in my own podcast, and he talked about anger as the force for change. And yeah, there probably is a bit of an anger there. But to not shy away from that, you know, yeah, I'm angry that a woman, pregnant woman, sleeping in a car. Why would you not be angry about that? You know? Mm-hmm. But it's also like a belief in, and I just can't understand why things can't be done in a better, more humane, more joyous, beautiful, creative, caring way in all sorts of areas, whether that concerning the environment, ecology. It's so many things I just feel are obvious if we just get on with it and make it happen. And sometimes you just need to make that push, but it's not a one way street. Like for me, I've not always, but can earn a living out of this. You know, a lot of my work's obviously voluntary, and but you know, I've earned somewhat of a living over the years out of it, through nonprofits and so on. And it's, but more importantly, it's given me a richness to my life in terms of the people I've met, the stories I've heard, the places I've gone, and feeling that I'm connected and part of the whole rather than separate, and that I'm part of a greater story. And I feel we all are, you know, and there may be a time where, well, there are times where I pull back as well and just have to focus on the more mundane aspects. But you know, it's not that I'm always out front and center charging ahead. Those things happen periodically, but I don't know if I'd be able for that, to be honest. It's that takes its toll, you know. Activism takes its toll on people, and you need to kind of, as I said earlier, keep fuel in the fire. And I've huge respect for anyone, including politicians, that live that life where they're continually up and at it. And it's pretty gruesome stuff, and it takes a lot of mastery and willpower and discipline and support to do it. So there are many greater minds and hearts and people and courageous people that really, in fact, really put themselves on the line, you know. They're the real activists, and like that really sacrificed even their freedom, you know. So you have to be mindful of those people and to kind of, to show solidarity for them, you know, and to get in behind them. And so there's always going to be a new generation coming up, and as there is, and it's so encouraging to see the younger folk, particularly around climate marches and young females in particular, a lot of young female leaders emerging. And two of my role models at the moment are they're no longer teenagers, but, you know, Malala and Greta Thunberg, like they're like 20 or whatever. But like, I think there's a big dynamic unfolding around gender as well, and to see and need and support more feminine and female leadership to come to the fore in the change that we need.
Yeah, that's great. It is great. And it is a big passion of mine. That's what I was saying about the path being different. You did this phone out number of years ago, and I got involved with the Lust for Life in the last couple of years, because I just, we're doing something with teenagers, and that's what really inspires me. The thought that something or somebody out there, a new Greta Thunberg or whatever it may be, just can make a change somewhere. It could be as small as, you know, in La Hinch for the moment, and may spread out in all County Clare eventually, you know. And that's really I was just curious to hear from you, because there's always this idea that now social media is just a big evil and things don't happen, that there's no soul. But I think there's a lot more than that. You know, there's a lot more soul out there from the young people that they're giving credit for.
Big time. Yeah, big time.
Tell me about your last song, Rory, please.
Oh, so the last song is by an emerging, well, she's not that emerging, but she maybe isn't as well known as she will be soon. Her debut album is coming out next few months, and her name is Susan Quirk, and she happens to be my wife. And yeah, she's released 4 singles so far in the last few years, and her album's ready to go. She's going to be releasing a new single soon. But this song is, it's called I Like the Way, and it's a celebration of our marriage, actually. And yeah, it's a fun, rocky, indie, cheeky number. And we made a video together for the song. We filmed it ourselves, and we just had so much fun making the video. But the lyrics around, like, no shackles bind us, we are free together. So when we were getting married, we had this vow around, you know, that sometimes you hear, particularly as a guy, that marriage is, sometimes there's a negative view of it's a ball and chain, you know. You've probably heard that before.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so that's a shackle. And then, so you had this, like, inherited negative messaging that sometimes is transferred, and it's a kind of a protest to that, and to say, like, you know, no shackles bind us, like, you can be free together, you can still be free to pursue your own paths, your dreams, your joys, and still be together in that journey. And so we both travel our own paths, but we travel a path together at the same time. And yeah, I'm really proud of her music and her personhood, and yeah, it's just so much respect for anyone creating music or creating art or podcasts or putting themselves out into the world to share themselves. So, good tune, good woman, good rocker.
You too much longer, because I'm sure you're busy as well. But I just want to, it just bring back to my, you were talking about spun out and how you burned yourself out because, you know, you're pushing. That was, you know, it's still doing great work, and it's reached millions of people over the years. So it's fantastic legacy to have. But it always, the whole mental health stroke, depression, stroke, anxiety and all that, it always strokes me. Like, a lot of people working within it, they do get burnout. They do get, you know. Now, with few years experience, what would you say to the young activists that we're talking to or talking about at the moment? What would you say, you know, what would you do again if you were to start spun out again? What would you do different?
Yeah, what would I do different? Well, I'm a big believer in mentorship. You know, ideally a mentor will come forward themselves, but sometimes you may need to seek it out, you know. And I think that just the general notion of the vulnerability of needing help and asking for help, and the wisdom and vulnerability to know that you need help, and that that none of us can do it alone. You know, so I think seeking out people that maybe have traveled their own path and maybe have learned a few things along the way to support you. But also then it's a double-edged thing whereby you don't want to just rely on other forces, voices, to rely on your inner voice more and to be very attuned to that. And that requires for me a degree of investment and practice around meditation, self-development, self-awareness, where you know yourself and you know your boundaries, you know your strengths, you know your weaknesses, you know your dreams, you know your hopes, you know your fears, to know thyself, as the saying goes. You know, and then I guess the boldness to not fear, the boldness and the courage required to step forward that sometimes the culture or the conditioning, whether it be society or parents or structures, can prevent people from believing in themselves or from throwing up barriers and obstacles in front of them. And sometimes you can do it to yourself. You can put up your own barriers and obstacles, but to forge through with that boldness, with a sword of courage to cut through, and then to know when to forge on and to know when to pull back, to know when to stop, to know when to rest, to reflect, to renew. So Gandhi used to lead these great marches for Indian independence and the salt marches and so on. But he would always also do a retreat to rest, reflect, renew before forging on again. So there's a great quote by the monk and mystic Thomas Merton that talks about the rush and pressure of modern life, that it can be seen as a form of contemporary violence. And he says, to allow oneself to be carried away by the multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone in everything is also to succumb to violence. And he says the frenzy and activity neutralizes our work for peace. It destroys our own inner capacity for peace, and that it destroys the fruitfulness of our work because it kills the root of inner wisdom, which makes the work fruitful. So it's a really powerful quote, very powerful, you know. And as an activist or anyone doing activism, to reflect on how we perhaps inflict violence on ourselves and others. So a lot in that. But, you know, there is, I think there was a band, The Levelers, didn't they? They had a song. I can't remember. It was like, the only way in life is your own, you know. So what advice do I have? It's like to follow your own way, to find your own way.
That's fair enough. Thanks for that. So, okay, look, tell me about your book. What would you pick? What would you recommend anybody? It doesn't have to be anything related to the conversation, anything at all. The last thing you read.
Yeah. Well, I'm reading White Tiger at the moment. Really enjoying that. It's a great book set in India. And
I just watched the movie last night. That's brilliant.
Oh, yeah. I'm dying to watch the movie.
Oh, that's it.
I'm getting a lot out of that at the moment. And I suppose the other book that comes to mind is Anthony DeMello's book, Awareness. So they're two very different books, really. But Awareness is a real... I like them because I like Eckhart Tolle as well. And I love that kind of stuff, that it just brings you right down to neutral and earth you in, grounds you in. But DeMello does that, but he also gives you a bit of a kick in the arse at the same time, which sometimes I need.
So thanks, Emilio, for your time. Yeah. And who knows, one of these days we might even meet face to face. You'll never know.
Brilliant. Well, listen, I really enjoyed the chat. It's interesting for me to be on the other side of the interview, you know. And I've done all sorts of media interviews, but they tend to be very like bang, bang, bang. So it's interesting to have that kind of reflective space. Thanks again.
Great. Take care.
Yeah.
I'm still rambling around the world with my songs and this guitar. Never got to sell 1 million. I'm still playing in bars, these shady, dim lit bars. No, I heard it through the grapevine. You're to marry soon. All my love fell by the wayside. I guess that I'm a fool, a lonely rambling fool.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Rory. For more episodes, please visit andreasplendori.com, and if you get a chance, give us a review and a few stars. Thank you.
But if I meet you somewhere far down the line, the sun still shines in your hair, I kiss you once, then I'll say, yeah, if I meet you someplace far down the line, The sun still shines in your face. I'll kiss you once, then I'll say goodnight. Then I'll say goodnight.